Well, hello there, and welcome to Food Lab Talk. I'm your host, Michael Bucker. Today's guest is a renowned nutrition scientist who spent the past 30 years studying what to consume and what to avoid for optimal health. Dr. Christopher Gardner is a professor of medicine and a research professor at Stanford University in California. Among other things, his research investigates the forces and factors that can successfully motivate people to improve their food choices and behaviors. This includes the notion of stealth nutrition, which focuses on shifting diets through the integration of non-health-related approaches, like the connection between food and climate change, institutional food, and the microbiome. And you may have recently seen him on Netflix in the series, You Are What You Eat. Welcome to the show, Christopher. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Michael, this should be fun. I'm looking forward to it also.
So to get things started, Christopher, I want to hear a little bit more about this Netflix series, You Are What You Eat. I've watched it. It's really, really good. And without showing my biases, how does a nutrition researcher at Stanford get involved in Hollywood filmmaking? And what has been the series' impact on you and your lab?
Yeah, well, this has been one of the most exciting things I've ever done, but it all is just a whole bunch of serendipity. So I've been doing what I call feed 'em and bleed 'em studies for decades now. And we were actually approached by the producer, Luis Cejollos, who had done Game Changers. And that was a documentary 3 or 4 years ago on Netflix. And he was interested in doing something else. He said, I have a potential contract with Netflix and I have a potential donor for a study. I'd like to study vegans somehow. I have a hook thinking of identical twins. If we gave you, you know, so much money, I don't know how to do a study. How would you do it, Christopher? How many would you have and what would you measure? I'm just interested in the general area. This was involving Justin Sonderberg, who's a colleague of mine, who is a microbiologist, world famous microbiologist. And another hook would be the microbiome and collecting poop in addition to blood, which is just right up my alley. Blood and poop and diet. What could be more fun? And this whole idea of the identical twins thing was really fascinating. A lot of people have given me credit for this in the study design. And it's not fair. It wasn't even my idea. It's funny, Michael, because it's sort of a partnering of scientific rigor and entertainment, right? I mean, people are fascinated by twins. But there is this level of scientific rigor where in my kind of study, we get a bunch of people and we say, okay, to make this scientifically rigorous, we're going to randomly assign half of you to this and half of you to that. And we hope in doing so that there are sleep differences, exercise differences, lots of differences, and they will cancel out after we've randomized you rather than letting you choose the diet you want to be on in a diet study. But identical twins takes this to the next level. They have the same genes. They got raised the same way. They don't have identical habits, but they're more similar to one another than to random people. So it really ratchets it up a knot in terms of scientific control. But really, for anybody who saw it, aren't they adorable? Aren't they fun? They were so funny to work with, finishing each other's sentences and teasing one another the whole time. So I really just fell into this.
So interesting. And then thinking back from watching the series, there were like 40 twins that you found?
So there's 44 people and 22 pairs of twins. And 21 out of the 22 finished the whole thing. In fact, only one person dropped out. But an interesting thing is then their twin was useless, right? Because if they were being compared to their twin, that the other twin was like, come on, brother, sister, we're going to be in a movie. And no, sorry, I got to drop out. So pretty good retention that we got 21 out of 22 pairs to do it all.
And I'm so curious is whether they knew up front all the things they would have to do on camera.
Well, actually, I can't attest to that. I can attest to whenever we do a study, let me just tell you my funny approach to a study, just because I know how hard these are. A lot of my colleagues prefer to work with mice and rats, right? Because they always show up. You can chop their head off. You can grind up their spleen and their liver, right? And find out all kinds of things. But yeah, humans don't let you do that. And what's really bad for a research study is if you get people to sign up and halfway through, a whole bunch of them quit, not really understanding what it is. So My colleague Justin, in fact, was just very concerned the first time he attended one of my orientation meetings with participants when we had sort of lined them up and they jumped through a few hurdles, but they had to attend what we call an orientation. And at the orientation, I said, now, are you sure you want to do this? We're going to poke you with needles. We're going to bleed you. We're going to suck blood out of you. You have to collect poop, put it in your freezer, tell your family not to open the poop in the freezer. And he was very concerned, like, oh my God, why are you telling them this? No one's going to do this. But I have learned over time that by the time they get there, most of them are fairly committed. And I'm actually trying to get a couple to quit. I'm trying to get anybody sort of faint of heart who wouldn't be able to make it through the whole thing to say, no, I get it. I'm in. So at least from the study perspective, they knew all of that going in.
But I hear you're a great sales manager.
Yeah, I have fun doing this. I have fun doing science.
Yeah, it showed in the documentary. But let's park that. So before we dive deeper into enabling choice, Christopher, love to chat with you for a moment about the bigger picture, the food system as a whole. So I've heard you say in the past, if universities, work sites, hospitals, and schools change the foods they order and serve, that kind of institutional demand can change agricultural practices, a true systems level approach to achieving healthier dietary behaviors. Can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah. And let me tell you how this started. I had been a philosophy major in undergrad. And at one point, 6 years out of my undergrad, I thought, well, I'm a vegetarian now. And I'm a philosophy major who worked in a lot of restaurants, because that's what you get when you're a philosophy major. I think I'll start a vegetarian restaurant. I know people are going to make fun of my protein and they're going to say, where do you get your protein? And I'm so sick of that question. I'll get a master's degree so that I have an articulate response to that. And to make a long story short, I didn't get the master's degree. I never opened the restaurant. I got a PhD. I got a Stanford faculty position. I got millions of dollars of NIH funding, National Institutes of Health, to do randomized controlled trials, the gold standard of science. And early in my career, I did several of these studies. One of them worked. One of them was actually two low-fat diets. One was very plant-based low-fat, and one was very convenience food low-fat. But they're, in a very scientific way, were matched for calories, for amount of saturated fat and cholesterol. And with a plant-based approach to it, I doubled their LDL cholesterol lowering. And at the end, I said, wow, you guys, $750,000, and this worked. Go forth and eat healthfully. And they said, are you going to keep providing the meals to us? I said, no, that was an experiment. Go eat. And they said, well, we don't cook very much, and we're probably just going to go back to eat what we were doing before. One of the things that had worked in that study, or that had been part of the diet in that study, was garlic. So it was very rich in garlic in the plant-based diet. And I got another grant just to study garlic. 200 people joined. It was $1.4 million. For 6 months, they got heart-healthy sandwiches that either did or didn't have mashed up garlic from Gilroy in the salsa, or they got garlic pills. It was very elaborate. At the end, no one's cholesterol changed. Nothing. It's like, I had a big presentation for this study also, as we always do. And I said, hey, everybody, thank you so much. That was a super expensive study. It didn't work. And three of the people stayed after the presentation was closed and said, where did you buy the supplements? And I said, why do you want to know? And they said, well, we'd like to order them. I said, I just spent 4 years of my life and 2 hours of your time explaining that it doesn't work. And they said, yeah, but we think it worked for us. And it was like, I did a study that worked and they won't do it. I did a study that didn't work and they're going to do it anyway. And so here I am thinking that I had exceeded all my expectations. I just wanted a vegetarian restaurant, Michael. And instead I had the faculty position and I'm in medical conferences and I'm finding things and they're not changing. Around that time, we saw an advertisement from the National Institutes of Health to try to come up with novel approaches for young adults to prevent obesity or weight gain. And so the idea here was, boy, we're not doing very good at helping people lose weight that they've already gained. Maybe we should focus on not having them gain any weight. young adults is the demographic portion that gains weight the fastest. It was supposed to be novel because young adults feel impervious and the normal messages don't work. And we proposed something called social responsibility and engagement. And it was brilliant, and it wasn't funded. And when we were done with this application, my partner and I talked and said, you know, it would have helped if we had pilot data. In a scientific process, if you have pilot data when you're proposing something, you might be more likely to get funded if you can show there's a good chance that it might work. And I naively said, I know, but you have to have money to get a pilot study done, and there's a lot of complications. How would we do that? And he looked at me and he said, you moron, we're on a campus of young adults. We can study them for free. Let's have a class. We will start a new class at Stanford, call it Food and Society, and we will test our principles and compare the students in our class to the students in classes of our colleagues. And I said, wow, that sounds pretty good. I've actually never started a new class. How long does that take? And a month later, Food and Society was eligible to be enrolled in. It was a discussion-based class. It was 20 students. There were no medical science papers. It was all focused on popular social food-oriented issues. So we had Michael Pollan's Omnivore's Dilemma. We had Barbara Kingsolver's Animal Vegetable Miracle. We had Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation. We had Marion Nestle's Food Politics. That class changed my whole career trajectory, Michael, because over the course of that class, we did collect data, and I'll just jump ahead and said we had pilot data, we resubmitted it, and we never got the grant funded. Okay, but throughout the class, the students would show up early, they would be fully engaged in discussions, they were respectful discussions, but their food choices were being challenged, they were trying new things. They were telling us, oh my God, we're sending the books home to our parents. I'm trying to get my brother or sister to change. From a behavior change perspective, it was so powerful. And so here's my most fun tale to tell from this class. I really did it selfishly to get pilot data to run a study that was never funded and never run. But it was so gratifying and satisfying to do this class that I wanted to do it again. So at the end of the course, I said, look, this was a blast. I think I'm going to offer this course again, but I'm quite curious which topics resonated the most with you, and I'd like to get rid of the ones that were the least and maybe add some new ones. So I'll just simplify this real quickly. The first woman in the class that I asked, with tears in her eyes, said that she had gone vegetarian because of the animal rights and welfare issue that we had covered in class. And the kid right next to her said, oh, I'm not crying. I grew up on a ranch. We treated our animals really well. But I didn't know anything about sort of the greenhouse gas and the emissions implications. So I only eat grass-fed beef now, which is what my family raises. But I've really avoided all the others, not knowing what that was. And the kid next to them said, well, you know, I think the whole climate change thing is a hoax. We come from a very conservative family. So I'm not going to buy that argument. But boy, Eric Schlosser had this very interesting argument about a dozen fast food restaurants opening up in Harlem at one point, many of them getting small business loans, and they went under. And the fast food franchises didn't lose any money. They make their money from rent. The small business owners lost their shirts and didn't repay their loans. And being fiscally conservative, this really upsets me that those small loans weren't repaid. And so I do not eat at fast food restaurants anymore. And I'm like, wait a sec. I've been running these randomized trials funded by the NIH, and I can't get people to change. You guys read these books. You went vegetarian. You're only eating grass-fed beef. You don't go to fast food restaurants anymore. And what was clear was that there wasn't a single topic that was the most resonant for everyone. There were different topics for different students. But when we put the collection of them together, they were all doing the things that my studies were showing that they should have done from sort of the nutrition mechanistic rationale that way. So it was these external societal motivators that were more compelling for them than the health. And it was at that point that I said, boy, I really am glad I have a nutrition PhD. I like having that in my back pocket. I know what the science is. I can explain the mechanism. But if I want behavior change, I'm going to need some new partners who understand all these other issues. And the other thing that became quite apparent at that time, because I've now spun this off, Michael, And I now have a second related class, not called Food and Society, but called Healthy and Sustainable Systems, recognizing that if all the universities, all the hospitals, all the work sites, all the food banks changed the thousands of pounds of food that they're dealing with on a daily basis for hundreds of thousands of people, you could change agriculture. And so one of my epiphanies at that point was, gosh, I really would like people to make better choices. And I'm finding that one of the limitations are they're at school, they're at work, they're at this other place where food is offered, and those choices aren't available. And boy, I can feel for the farmers who are struggling to making a living wage as it is. What if I said, hey, I'm this hoity-toity professor at Stanford, and I think you should grow lentils instead of raising cattle. There's no way they're going to listen to me. That doesn't make any sense. But what if Stanford Dining, Stanford Hospital, the work sites that were available said, hey, we're ordering different food and we will buy it. So that institutional food setting for me suggested a possibility, a way to scale up ordering different types of foods. And I, at this point, I really don't think we can change the food trajectory we're on unless we change agriculture. I don't think the farmers are going to want to change unless they know they can make a living. And I think institutional food settings who are catching on, all of which, most of which are dealing with chefs, and I have a great relationship with the Culinary Institute of America. I do a lot of work with chefs. If you not only change what they're ordering, but make it unapologetically delicious, you could change the world.
Hear, hear. And I've heard that before. I love that story, Christopher. So let's dive into the theme of this season, enabling individuals to make informed, personally relevant food choices. So what can we do? So that's a straightforward question, Christopher. How do you answer that one? How might we enable individuals to make informed, personally relevant food choices? What is it that individuals actually need, and what is it that sits with the individual versus what might sit with the system?
Yeah, a huge part is the food environment that needs to change. The food has to be available, but that's not your question. So let me shamelessly promote the book that I have a book contract for, but it's not finished yet. It won't be out for a while. And there's two really basic themes to this, and they are instead of what and with what. So as a professor who teaches nutrition, I bet you can imagine that every year students come up to me and say, Professor Gardner, should I eat fish? Should I eat or avoid dairy? They have all kinds of questions for me. And my answer to the class is always, well, if this ends up being on an exam somewhere, if your first answer is it depends, you immediately get 50% credit. And then you have to fill in the it depends with what and instead of what. So I hope you'll allow me one exercise that I've been offering to people to think of it this way. Eggs. Boy, eggs are really a challenging topic. Yes, they have cholesterol. If you really wanted to go into the metabolism, I could bore the pants off you explaining why the cholesterol in an egg doesn't directly go into your artery. There's the liver in the middle. It's actually more the saturated fat that raises your blood cholesterol than the cholesterol in an egg. Yeah, you don't want to hear that right now. You want to hear my fun story. So my fun story is, go to the store and first of all, you have to decide whether you're going to buy plain or cage-free or pasture-raised or fertile or omega-3. So let's say you got some eggs. Professor Gardner, are eggs good for me? I'm going to say, well, you know, what are you having it with? So here's just scrambled eggs plain. Here's cheesy eggs because I melted some cheese on it. Here's eggs with bacon and sausage. And here's a veggie omelet that's stuffed with vegetables, topped with salsa, with a little fruit on the side. I actually think those are all different eggs because of what they came with. And then they say, yeah, but I've been eating steel-cut oats forever. You know, I'm a vegetarian, vegan, plant-based person, so I've been avoiding eggs. And I don't know, technically that veggie omelet is plant-based. If you put a ton of veggies in the middle of it and there's fruit on the side, it's more plants than egg. So I have this conversation and somebody goes off and says, well, you know, I really have bought into this whole plant-based thing. And so I had steel-cut oats Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and it's Sunday. should I have those steel cut oats again? Or do you think I should have the veggie omelet? And I say, oh my God, get some freaking variety in your diet. Have the dang veggie omelet on Sunday. And they come back a week later and they said, God, I took that to heart. And so 3 days this week, I had the steel cut oats. And 3 days this week, I had the veggie omelet. But now I'm all conflicted about Sunday. I still have to deal with Sunday because I did 3 and 3. Professor Gardner, what should I have? And at that point, I say, you could have the damn Pop-Tarts on Sunday. At this point, you ate so well Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Lighten up a little. Have a little joy. Maybe that Pop-Tart reminds you of your youth and your dad used to bake Pop-Tarts for you before you went out for your weekend hike. And it's emotionally enriching to remember that with a taste of a Pop-Tart. So if you do this with what and instead of what, a lot of the nutrition controversies aren't quite as controversial. And you'd find a lot more agreement among people if you really put it in terms of the food in front of you and what you had before and what you're going to have after. Some of those controversies just melt away. And it's a lot more fun to talk about food with people in that context.
I hear you, but you have completely now confused me with eggs. Should I eat them or not? Because she's made it more, you made it more complicated. So I'm going to go back to the question. So if it would really be a black and white question, so if our goal is to enable individuals to help them to make personally relevant, informed food choices, you can only pick one. You cannot tell me, no, there's more, Michael, blah-de-blah-de-blah. Is it knowledge? Is it the food environment? Is it your passion? Is it balance? What is it that you would start with? You can only pick one.
No, I won't answer it. Because for me, and I'll tell you why I won't answer it, I have a PhD in nutrition science. I still change my diet to this day based on those different factors. Like for me, food is a journey. And I don't want to be paralyzed into inaction. Some of the students in my class at one point or another say, oh my God, I'm not sure if I can eat. I now know so much about the challenges of food that I don't believe anything and I'm just not going to eat. I said, no, you have to go eat. But you will get more knowledge and you'll get more aligned with your personal values. But of all the factors that you named, I guess you're looking for a first one. And what I consistently find in people is, there isn't one that works across everyone. Everyone is so different. You have to have them all, and you have to allow yourself a little grace and kindness that you won't understand at all. Let's say you've sort of got a dietary habit established. It works really well for you. You go shopping. You're comfortable with your sources. You go to the farmer's market, and then you show up at the farmer's market, and one of the vendors is gone. They went out of business, and you knew how they grew their food. You are going to have to replace that with somebody else. How hard would it be? Talk to another vendor. An issue that I hit all the time is something like organic. And at a farmer's market, I'll give you a really common scenario is somebody say, is your food organic? And every once in a while, somebody will say no. But the patron has walked away at that point. They wanted organic. And what they didn't listen to was, and I actually exceed the organic requirements. I'm a small farm. I can't afford the certification, but I actually meet and exceed the requirements. Therefore, I would be a good replacement for the vendor that you used to buy from that's gone. So you'd have to take that extra step and extra energy to learn something new, even though you had your habits all set, but it wouldn't take you long. Then you'd have that vendor for a while. And there's something else to learn about food. I now add, because of the microbiome, kimchi to my avocado toast. One of my staple breakfasts is avocado toast. And having studied the microbiome and learning about fermented food, now one of my staple breakfasts is avocado toast and kimchi. For 63 years, it wasn't, but from 64 onward, I'm pretty sure it's going to be avocado toast and kimchi for a while. And so I'm not going to beat myself up for not having recognized that early. The whole thing about the microbiome is fascinating. It's emerging science. It is not resolved science. I mean, take that for your point about knowledge. I see a lot of people really interested in the microbiome. If they left this audio show right now and went out and read for weeks and weeks about the microbiome, they would not be able to resolve what the personal food choice issues were for them, because we are generating lots of fascinating information on the role of the microbiome in health, how it is affected by fiber, which is prebiotics. That's what sort of feeds the bugs in your gut. And probiotics or fermented foods are actually the live microbes that make their way to your gut. Oh, it is a fascinating topic. So many different fields are getting interested in this. So much marketing is going on for products, but we don't understand it. So if knowledge was most important, Michael, none of your listeners right now could go out and figure the whole thing out. It's going to be emerging for years. So I'm a scientist. So yes, knowledge is everything, except, oh, what about behavior and fun and cultural appropriateness? No, it's a balance. Sorry, I refuse to answer your question.
Noted. So, Christopher, I think some of your more recent research is on the concept of stealth nutrition. A stealth approach in terms of presenting environmental sustainability as a motivating factor for healthful diet changes. I think it's stealth nutrition in general is one of those interesting terms as well. Talk to me a little bit about stealth nutrition and how you tie it to other dimensions as well.
Yeah. And I want to start out by saying stealth is not deceit in this case. Like, I'm not trying to trick anyone. And I think actually cauliflower rice is a bit of trickery. If you told somebody I made you cauliflower rice, that's one thing. If you said, here's the rice, I hope they don't notice it's actually cauliflower rice. Right? So in my mind, stealth nutrition is recognizing how many different aspects and domains of food choices influence people's eventual decisions of what they put in their mouth. And so I've tried to explain why the saturated fat and the cholesterol in their diet will lower their LDL cholesterol in their blood. And their eyes glazed over. And I said, could we talk about the animal rights and welfare thing? Nope, don't want to hear that. Not willing to, no. Are you an eco warrior? Oh, I just bought, a Prius and I have a Leaf and I have an electric car and I ride my bike Oh, so you're an eco warrior. Have you sort of looked at greenhouse gases and land use, water use, biodiversity, eutrophication? So stealth nutrition for me is having enough of those in my back pocket that I can hook somebody, because we're finding that if you do take into account animal rights and welfare, greenhouse gases, economy, a couple things like that. In fact, Michael, at this point, one of my challenges is I feel like I have a core set of those factors ready to share and some good facts. Is it going to be helpful to add water? Oh, water and growing almonds and water and some of these other things. There's a lot of plants that actually take a lot of water to grow plant food with water as opposed to livestock grazing somewhere else. How many more do I have to have? What I'd really like is just to have enough in my tool chest that I can get almost everybody with this set. I didn't get them with nutrition, but can I get them with these other things? And once I've got them engaged in what I think is stealth nutrition, because I have multiple angles of approaching them, when I watch the behaviors after they've fully appreciated those different angles, they all align quite well, basically with a plant-based diet that's reasonably seasonal and appropriately local. But boy, if you're in the middle of the winter in the Midwest, in the North, you can't get fresh food. If you take all those into account, it pretty much aligns pretty well with a healthy diet that was reported in the Eat Lancet report a couple of years ago, American Heart Dietary Guidelines for Americans. There's really a lot more agreement than disagreement in those. And if you use this stealth nutrition approach, you can get a lot of alignment with it and resonate with a lot more people than telling them you should avoid this and you should eat that.
Yeah, I like your definition. Stealth is not deceit. I think that is so true. Christopher, I think we can talk for hours about your experience and your insights. As we're almost out of time, I'm going to ask you one closing question. So, probably the biggest audience for this show are change makers working in food systems. And you, having been around, played around for a little bit, might you share some of your biggest learnings in how to get things done in the world of food?
I would say the biggest thing for me is humility. like, I am a nutrition scientist. I understand the mechanism. You should eat that. Oh, no, there is that business aspect, the marketing aspect, the legal aspect, the policy aspect, the cultural aspect, the historical aspect. Oh my God, the storytelling aspect. Really, what I've learned in getting grants and participating in this Netflix series, things like this, the narrative is so much more important for the final behavior change than the science. And that involves some humility for me because I have a PhD. I'm a professor in a school of medicine at Stanford University. My currency is published papers and scientific fact and knowledge. And that falls short for most people, not just many people, most people, but the narrative that goes with it, the humility to recognize how many other disciplines and factors are tugging at people's tongues and hearts and brains has really been the greatest learning experience for me and the most satisfaction saying, oh my God, look at that Netflix series. There's actually a couple things about the Netflix series that bother me, but at the end of the day, a stunning number of people I've never met are contacting me, telling me they're changing their diet. And it's the magic of I know what it is. The narrative was woven into that presentation. It was visual. It was entertaining. And one of the most interesting emails I got from someone was, this is the best piece of science communication I have seen in a decade because the viewers don't realize they're getting science communication. It was engaging.
And with that, Christopher, thank you for spending time with me and sharing, you know, your interesting insights and learnings over the years as well. And I did not know about you aspiring to be a restaurant operator.
If I ever lose my professor job, I have a backup.
Yep.
I'll go open the restaurant.
Totally. And I will frequent your place. With that, Christopher, thank you so much. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, Michael, it's really been a pleasure. Thanks.
I had a lot of fun chatting with Christopher. Reflecting on today's interview, here are my top three takeaways for changemakers. Understanding diverse motivations and preferences fuels effective change-making strategies. Christopher's concept of stealth nutrition, leading with non-health benefits or information like animal welfare or climate change, has proven to help even the least likely of people to make better food choices. Consider the peripheral benefits to the change you hoped to drive and how you might use them to win over your skeptics. Our choices can have a powerful influence on the broader system. Christopher's work highlights the transformative impact of small changes to on-campus dining operations, celebrating plant-forward dishes and embracing the principle of elevating deliciousness. Making these changes at an institutional level drives large-scale impact, not only on campus, but for farmers and food manufacturers, shifting the overall system toward healthier and more sustainable options. And thirdly, our ability to inspire change hinges on how we convey the reasons to believe. If you've been following our podcast, you're likely well-versed in the levers of change, decision-making science, and evidence-based food systems transformation. But here's the key. This knowledge gains power in the stories we tell and the actions we take. I loved Christopher's approach to communicating science using unconventional tools like New York Times bestsellers, documentaries, and living laboratories to inspire the next generation of changemakers. For more information about You Are What You Eat, and the research studies described in today's episode, be sure to check out the show notes. And thank you for joining us for this episode. If you liked what you've heard, subscribe to the podcast at foodlabtalk.com or wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to follow us on LinkedIn and YouTube at foodlabtalk. As we close, I invite you to pursue your own bold vision and take whatever action you can take toward a better food system. Imagine, believe, and most importantly, act. See you next time.